brings you three remarkable musicians who blend European and African-American traditions in tap. A city that absorbs the rhythms of the world through its feet and a remarkable soundtrack to modern urban life. Between the Ears, Tap City. Tonight at 9:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, the time is 1 o'clock. This is BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio and also online. Well, it's time now for the news with David Cornett.
Scottish fishing fleets will be allowed to land more of some types of fish, but they'll face fewer days at sea after talks in Brussels. The Scottish Fishermen's Federation says the cuts in their days at sea are a bitter blow. The UK Fisheries Minister, Richard Bennion, says he's secured the best possible deal for the industry after 3 weeks of negotiations. The credit rating agency Fitch is warning that a comprehensive solution to the Eurozone debt crisis is technically and politically beyond reach. It says it's considering downgrading six members, including Italy and Spain. As many as 250 people are feared to have died and hundreds more are missing after a tropical storm hit the southern Philippines. Many of the victims were asleep when it struck. Tens of thousands of residents have been moved to evacuation centres and soldiers have been mobilised to rescue people trapped on the roofs of their houses. David Cameron has urged the Church of England to lead a revival of traditional values to counter what he called Britain's moral collapse. In a speech, he said tolerance of immoral behaviour had helped to fuel this summer's riots and greed in the City of London and abuse of MPs' expenses. The Scottish Labour Party has announced that its new leader will be Johan Lamont. She replaces Ian Gray, who stepped down after the Scottish National Party's victory in the Holyrood elections in May. An Iraqi delegation has arrived in Syria to explore ways of ending the violent suppression of anti-government protests. Iraqi leaders say they're in touch with Syrian opposition groups as well as President al-Assad's government. They're hoping to implement the Arab League's peace proposals, which include sending in foreign observers to monitor an end to the violence. Wildlife experts say mistletoe could disappear from Britain's woodlands within 20 years. The National Trust says the orchards in which the plant grows are rapidly disappearing and fewer people know how to manage and harvest it. And the weather, snow will settle even at low levels in northern Scotland. It'll be largely dry and sunny in eastern Britain, but there'll be scattered wintry showers across the country. BBC News and Weather at 3 minutes past one.
Read by David Cornett. I'm Jill Anderson. Very good afternoon to you. In an hour's time at 2 o'clock, there's another chance to hear last Monday's recital from Wigmore Hall in London. A recital given by the soprano Véronique Jean and the pianist Susan Manoff. Songs by Massenet, Gounod and Ronaldo Hahn. And then at three in Saturday Classics, the conductor John Wilson presents the first of four programmes offering a personal selection of film music, beginning with the Hollywood greats. So I hope you'll be able to stay with us here on Radio 3. Right now, it's time to join Lucy Skeeping for today's edition of The Early Music Show.
Unmistakably medieval sound. This is the tune Angelus ad Virginem, performed as an estampie by the Noise of Minstrels. I guess we tend to use the word minstrels fairly loosely. I imagine a lone musician, perhaps in two-tone tights, singing to a maid Marian-type lady with long, crinkly hair, all very pre-Raphaelite, and representing the free spirit of the muse in some mythical world. course, in reality, it wasn't much like that. Wandering minstrels certainly did exist in the Middle Ages, but they were just as likely to have been rough, hard-nosed musos as the graceful individuals depicted in the poems and paintings of the 19th century. In fact, many of them were viewed with suspicion by the authorities, as vagabonds even, along with jugglers, acrobats, dancers and storytellers, whose very independence could be seen as a threat to the social order. Some minstrels, though, were classified as servants on the payroll of some great house or royal court. Others, known as waits, were employed by municipal authorities to walk around the town walls and keep the watch at night, and, when necessary, to sound the alarm on loud instruments. But as early as the 1300s, there began to be a sense amongst them that they needed to get together to protect their interests, to form a sort of trade union or fraternity. There were many obstacles to overcome in its evolution and many stops and starts, not least from some of the musicians themselves, but an officially recognised worshipful company of musicians did eventually come about. And it's still with us today, in a slightly different form perhaps, but as active as ever. To find out more about it, I invited into the studio two leading members of the company to trace some of the pivotal moments in its 500-year history. Richard Crudston has written a book on the company's origins, and Paul Campion is an immediate past master. But before we talked about its beginnings, I asked Paul to outline some of the company's present-day activities.
Well, the company these days is largely a charitable organisation, and it offers help, financial help. It offers performance opportunities to young musicians coming out of conservatoires through bequests given specially through the company. For example, it goes towards an award to a young singer at Glyndebourne, a young small role singer or chorus member at Glyndebourne every year, which is worth £10,000 to the winner. We have an award for jazz, acknowledging excellence in a young jazz performer. One of the most interesting awards, very important award, very big award on our part, is the Constant and Kit Lambert Award, which is made annually to the Royal College of Music. And it goes back to the composer-conductor Constant Lambert and his son Kit, who studied at the Royal College of Music many years ago. And through a family arrangement, family bequest, the royalties from the rock opera Tommy, for which Kit Lambert was the manager, Kit's proportion of the royalties from performances of Tommy come to the company to pass on to the Royal College of Music in the form of fellowships and bursaries and scholarships. And so we have that benevolent opportunity, and we have a link with very modern music, rock operas, Tommy, supporting young musicians now at the Royal College. And indeed, we have other bursaries and medals and so on at all the conservatoires throughout the country.
Paul Campion, the immediate past master of the Worshipful Company of Musicians. Well, as we've heard, the company's story can be traced back to medieval times. So let's set the scene with some more early dance music, a 15th century nota and an English estampie.
Thank you.
City Waits with two English dances from the 1400s. Richard Crudson is the author of Apollo's Swan and Lyre, a book which traces the history of the Worshipful Company of Musicians. And I asked him whether the earliest so-called minstrels did really travel around performing from castle to castle, as the storybooks suggest. And what evidence do we have that they got together to form a sort of minstrels' union or society?
They did start off individuals roaming around castles, yes. But gradually, as the towns developed, the cities developed, you'd find a group of minstrels in any city. And then there was one particular occasion when there was a royal wedding with the first daughter, about 1297, I think it was. And they had about 90 minstrels all coming to play at this, but all separately. Obviously, they weren't all playing like an orchestra. They all played separately. But that shows that just within 50 years or so of this first evidence we have of our company, they were beginning to group together. And they also had competitions for going back a very long time. They used to get together at a particular place. It might be London, it might be Bruges, it might be Arras, some places like that. And they all competed to see who was the best minstrel, and the best one won a prize.
Richard Crudson and many of the most popular tunes became known throughout Europe, passed around at these international competitions or get-togethers, or simply when musicians toured abroad with their employers. And as early as the mid-1300s, it seems that these freelance minstrels had begun to see the advantages of forming a fraternity.
Fraternity is the word, yes. It's quite different from a union, because all that they were really doing was setting up a mutual society. At this stage, there was no question of standards controlling how good or how bad a minstrel was. It was just a question of helping one another. If somebody was ill, then there was a box into which everybody contributed each year, and money could be paid out of the box to help the sick minstrels. That's really all it was at that stage. The original fraternity disappeared. The next thing which happened was in 1469, the king's minstrels were given a charter by the king. This is King Edward IV. And the interesting thing about this was that, unlike monarchs before and after, Edward IV concentrated his court in the City of London. And therefore, the King's Minstrels were based in London itself. And they had control over musicians all over the country. I mean, it was a very sort of wide-ranging thing.
When you say they had control, do you mean the royal musicians could actually decide who was in and who was out?
Yes, they could say you're not good enough. I mean, this was in theory, but you've got to remember the Wars of the Roses were going on at this time and the whole country was sort of split into all sorts of little groups. So it was rather fanciful that they could actually exercise that control, but they were given it by the charter. And then when Henry VII came along, he moved the whole court to Westminster, leaving the City of London out in the cold, as it were. And that's why the minstrels, the musicians by this time of London, decided to ask the City Corporation to incorporate them as a company in 1500.
Can you just explain exactly what a royal charter is?
Well, it was really the empowering act for any organisation to do anything. The king said, you may do it, and therefore you were allowed to do it. But as time went on, of course, the big cities became more and more independent. And that's why the livery companies, and there were many livery companies, of course, by 1500, and they're all very rich and very powerful. That's why the city minstrels decided to get themselves incorporated in the city under this Act of Incorporation of 1500.
Richard Crudson from the Worshipful Company of Musicians. So the King's Minstrels were the first musicians in England to be granted a royal charter. And it was important to them because although they did have the security of full-time employment, they were constantly being threatened by impostors who, as they put it in their petition of complaint, pretending to be the King's Minstrels and wearing the King's livery, collect in certain parts of the realm great extractions of money at festivals. But then there was also the problem of the city waits. As their name suggests, unlike royal musicians, waits were employed by the city itself. It was a job that could be traced back to medieval times, and they didn't see why they should now be forced to join the minstrels' company, particularly as membership was beyond the financial means of many of them. Indeed, to be a town wait had a prestige all of its own. No longer were they just keeping the watch and piping in the dawn and the dusk on loud instruments from the city walls. In fact, by the Elizabethan period, the city waits were in demand for all sorts of social events, from banquets to dances. York Waits with Anthony Holborn's Night Watch, and before that, the Broadside Band with a Bergamask Dance. Elizabeth I's reign was one of high times for the Musicians' Company. With members now drawn from both the City Waits and the King's Music, it represented some of the finest players in the country. And as Richard Crudson explains, on really grand occasions when a larger band was needed, these two groups might even find themselves working together.
What happened was that the Queen was entertaining an Italian duke, the Duke of Procacciano, and his name was Virginio Orsino, which is very suitable, and they decided they wanted to have a play. This was January 1601. They summoned up the King's players, and William Shakespeare wrote a play, which we all know, called Twelfth Night, and the famous hero, the Duke, was Orsino, very appropriately. And in order to make it a really good occasion, with the banquet and all the rest of it, they summoned up the musicians of the city, not to play in the play itself, but to provide the incidental music in between. So the musicians were sent for, and it was a very grand occasion. And I think it was interesting that so many of the musicians were actually members of the company and in the King's Music, Queen's Music, and also in City Waits.
So Shakespeare's Orsino was a real person. Sadly, we can't be sure about exactly what music was heard in the plays, but many songs do exist, penned by contemporaries or near contemporaries of Shakespeare, and others included in Shakespeare's texts may well have been sung to popular tunes of the day. Here are four pieces associated with Twelfth Night. The lively dance tune Kemp's Jig takes its name from Shakespeare's clown Will Kemp, and the set ends with the syncopace Galliard, as mentioned by Sir Toby Belch as he brags about his dancing talent. "My very walk should be a jig," he says. "I wouldn't so much as make water but in a syncopace." The joke is, of course, that he's referring to a version of the Galliard, the syncopace. In between, we'll hear the closing song of Feste the Clown, "When That I Was a Little Tiny Boy," which is sung to the popular ballad tune known as Tom Tinker. But to start, one of the most famous songs associated with Shakespeare, O Mistress Mine.
O Mistress Mine, where are you roaming? O Mistress Mine, where are you roaming? O stay and hear your true love's coming. O stay and hear your true love's coming, that can sing both high and low. Trip no further, pretty sweeting, journeys end in lovers' meeting, every wise man's son doth know. What is love, 'tis not hereafter, what is love, 'tis not hereafter, present mirth hath present laughter, present mirth hath present laughter, what's to come is still unsure. In delay there lies no plenty, then come kiss me, sweet and twenty, youth's a staff will not end you. Thank you. When that I was at a little tyne boy, with hey-ho, the wind and the rain, a foolish thing was but a toy, for the rain it raineth every day. But when I came to man's estate, with hey-ho, the wind and the rain, against knaves and thieves men shut their gate, for the rain it raineth every day. But when I came, alas, to wife, with hey-ho, the wind and the rain, by swaggering could I never thrive, for the rain it raineth every day. But when I came unto my beds, with hey-ho, the wind and the rain, with tosspots still and drunken heads, for the rain it raineth every day. A great while ago the world begun, with hey-ho, the wind and the rain, but that's all one, our play is done, and we'll strive to please you every day.
Broadside Band with John Potter and four pieces associated with Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and we're tracing the history of the Worshipful Company of Musicians, which is more than 500 years old and still going strong today. Paul Campion is a past master of the company, and I asked him about the status of musicians in the Elizabethan era. This was a time when the authorities were keen to clear the streets of itinerant minstrels who were often considered no better than vagrants. But did gaining a royal charter at least give legitimate musicians a higher status?
Yes, they were definitely very superior people in a very real way. And there were certain regulations about what they could do and what they couldn't do as part of their work. They could not, for example, walk in the street or go from house to house with an uncased instrument to be seen by any passing by. They could not play any instrument either night or morning under any nobleman, knight or gentleman's window, or lodging in the street, or in the window or lodging of any person whatsoever without the court's permission.
So sweet. You just think of all those sort of romantic songs in plays where people sang under windows to their sweetheart. Obviously, that wasn't going to happen, was
definitely
it?
Definitely not allowed in the city anyway at that stage, no.
Should I lose the sight of my darling once beloved, or should I live?
the Elizabethan dance tune Woodycock, preceded by Hannah Morrison and the group Pantagruel with the ballad Joy to the Person of My Love. Well, with the granting of their royal charter by James I, the worshipful company of musicians was now developing into a significant force to be reckoned with. But unfortunately, they hadn't bargained for a certain Nicholas Lanier. We'll hear what happened in a moment. But first, one of Lanier's songs, Bring Away This Sacred Tree.
Bring away this sacred tree, the tree of grace and bounty, set it in Melania's eye, for she can unknotted spells untie. Pulled from the stalk, let her blessed hand convey to any suppliant hand a bow, and let that hand advance it charm, that charm shall fade away. Pulled from the stalk, let her blessed hand convey to any suppliant hand a bow, and let that hand advance it against a charm, that charm shall fade away.
Bring Away This Sacred Tree by Nicholas Lanier, Paul Agnew and lutenist Christopher Wilson. Now, Lanier is quite an interesting character, a man of many talents who played a significant role in the story of the Worshipful Company of Musicians. And as Paul Campion explains, it wasn't a very positive one.
I think we could call him a real Jacobean courtier, because he came to prominence in the reign of James I as a viol player, a lutenist, and a composer. So he was a man of some consequence.
So as a courtier, he was more perhaps in with the royals than being simply an employee like the musicians?
Yes, I think he was a friend of the king's, very much so. And certainly when Charles I took over in 1625, it was Lanier who went to Italy to consider purchasing paintings from the collection of the Dukes of Mantua, and came back having purchased a great number of pictures. And, of course, that was very much the foundation of the royal collection of pictures as well. So here we have the link between pictures and music all brought together in the court of Charles I.
Nevertheless, as far as the Your Company is concerned, he was a controversial figure. What exactly did he do that was so troublesome?
Well, it's important to differentiate between the City of London, which we now know as the Square Mile, and the court at Whitehall. They were two quite separate bodies. And the problem with Lanier was that he had had problems in the city itself, in the City of London. He had been involved in a brawl and had upset some of the city fathers in those days. But he was a court man. He was a king's man, a man of the Whitehall court. And it was on that basis, in that role, that he soon spotted that there were problems in the Musicians' Company Charter of 1604. During the reign of Charles I, he realised that, according to the terms of the charter, the music at the court of Charles I was still officially under the control of the City of London musicians, which he certainly was not going to accept. That is why, after quite a lot of wheeler-dealing, Lanier managed to get the 1604 Musicians' Charter revoked. And in the 1630s, after having existed for about 30 years only, the company had no charter. They were acting without it, without that sort of authority.
No more shall needs be decked with flowers, nor sweetness
Grim death no more shall horrid
Paul Agnew and Christopher Wilson with Nicholas Lanier's No More Shall Meads Be Decked With Flowers. Hard to imagine, isn't it, how someone who could compose such a sublimely beautiful song could have been so very destructive towards his fellow musicians in the forming of the Worshipful Company. Well, our story is now moving towards the middle of the 17th century, the Commonwealth, when many of England's usual public entertainments were severely curtailed under Puritan ideology. It was all pretty disastrous for anyone in the entertainment business, and just when things in London seemed to be getting back to normal, along came the Great Fire, which would also have a major effect on the city's musicians. And funnily enough, it was the dancing masters, with their little pochette fiddles and repertoire of popular melodies, who came to the rescue of the musicians' company, as Richard Crudson explains.
It goes right back to the 1500s. The dancing masters were under the control of the company right back then. What really happened, I think, was that after the Great Fire of London, all the serious music making moved west into the West End. All that was left in the city, musically, really, were the people teaching the city residents how to dance, which was terribly important, and it was a social grace which they had to have. And they got so prominent in what they were doing that the French court sent their most distinguished dancing masters, a chap called Monsieur Isaac, over to London to learn the English dances. And the London dancing masters taught the English dances to him. He took them back to Paris, to Versailles, and at the same time, they borrowed some dances from France and started teaching those over here.
And these were all members of the Worshipful Company of Musicians?
Well, I can't say they all were, but there was a very substantial body of dancing masters who were actually, and they were the people who had the money, and they were the people who kept the company going.
Thank you.
city waits on pipes, fiddles, whistles, hurdy-gurdies, sittin' and a lot more, with three dances from Playford's anthology, The English Dancing Master, first published in 1651. That was Nine Pins, Jenny Pluck Pears and Half Hannikin. Well, Richard Crudson's book about the Worshipful Company of Musicians goes right up to the present day. But time's running out, I'm afraid. And this is the early music show, after all. So my thanks to him and to Paul Campion. And we'll end the programme with some more from the Playford anthology. These dances are often given rather a folksy feel, but in reality they were very much the kind of music that crossed class boundaries, as popular in the court, played by the royal musicians, as with the rough fiddlers, pipers and hurdy-gurdy players who earned their living amongst ordinary folk in the streets and taverns of London.
A medley of dances from Playford's anthology The Complete Dancing Master from 1651, played on that recording by the ensemble Cyrenou. And that ends today's early music show, which was presented by Lucy Skeeping. You can find all the details about the music in today's programme on the Early Music Show page of the Radio 3 website, and you can also download a podcast version of the programme from there next Monday. In next Saturday's Early Music Show, Lucy presents a programme for Christmas Eve, focusing on the French Baroque composer Marc-Antoine Charpentier. And that's at the same time, just after the 1 o'clock news, here on Radio 3.
So what have we got in the back of this car? We've got a Kalashnikov with two magazines strapped together. What else you got?
I've got my laptop, my printer, my tennis rackets, my first aid kits.
So everything a young man needs in Tripoli these days?
Yeah.
Jeremy Bowen looks back at a year that changed the face of the Middle East.
Crowd are coming my way now, as is a bit of the tear gas.
Tales from the Arab Spring.
They thought they'd beaten the old regime back in February. Now they think they have to fight it all over again. This crisis has been brewing for months.
On Monday to Wednesday morning at 11, over on BBC Radio 4.
Well, looking forward to tomorrow here on Radio 3. At noon, we start celebrating Christmas with its annual day of live and specially recorded concerts from around the European Broadcasting Union, presented by Louise Fryer. The day begins at St Christian's Church in Copenhagen with a concert from the Middle East Peace Orchestra. They include music from Jewish, Christian and Muslim traditions. At 1 o'clock, the soprano Maria Christina Kier and the Helsinki Baroque Orchestra perform 16th and 17th century Baltic and Mediterranean music in a live concert from Helsinki. Then at 3, Czech Baroque music ensemble Musica Floria perform music by one of the most important Bohemian Baroque composers, Jan Dismas Zelenka, at the Church of St Simon and St Jude in Prague. At 5, the vocal ensemble Capella Duriniensis perform a programme of Portuguese, medieval and Renaissance music. And at 6, the Freiburg Baroque Orchestra and the Collegium Vocale Ghent perform orchestral and choral music by Bach and more music by Zelenka, his Missa Dei Filii. That's Christmas around Europe here on BBC Radio 3, starting tomorrow at midday. Well, now it's 2 o'clock and time for another chance to hear last Monday's live Wigmore Hall concert. The presenter is Fiona Talkington.
The French soprano Véronique Jean is one of the outstanding Baroque performers of our time, but she's also passionate about the music of her homeland, and she's a great champion of French composers. And that's what she's going to perform for us today, together with the pianist Susan Manoff. Songs by Gounod, de Polignac and Reynaldo Ahn. And to begin with, Massenet. Massenet was best known in his own day for his operas, but he actually wrote some 200 songs, and Véronique Jean is going to sing 7 of them. Chant Provençal comes first. It's about a girl who hasn't yet blossomed into the beauty of womanhood, and the poet likens her to a newly opened flower. Rondelle de la Belle au Bois Dormant is a song to the Sleeping Beauty, telling her that Prince Charming is on his way. Then there's a spring song of praise to the birds who are building their nests. La Mort de la Cigale tells of the death of the cricket song ending as the corn is harvested. Then comes a song about the setting sun, and finally, Nuit d'Espagne, imitating a Spanish guitar. And applause now for Véronique Jean and Susan Manoff, who are going to begin this group of 7 songs by Massenet with the Chant Provençal.
Mireille ne sait pas encore, nous. Au bois dormant.